This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate Gee here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, good. We got another solo job for us tonight.
I know. We are missing Jen, but we march forward.
Yeah. Army has to go on.
Yeah.
Got it.
All right. Well, these questions are specifically are great for you because they are about some pop psychology terms that I have heard. And so I figure we just go straight to it and skip the small talk now that Jen
sure,
is not,
God knows with Jen here, we have to do the small talk. But now, whoosh, my goodness. We'll get her back soon, people. She's on her way home. All right. Let's go ahead, Nathan.
All right. Dear doctors, is there such a thing as going mad? Are similar expressions mostly just used to discredit people? What about things like mental breakdowns?
there is such a thing as going mad. It's interesting that they call it mad because maybe when people are really mad, they seem like they can get downright irrational and unpredictable and dangerous and, you know, et cetera. So, but what we call is a madness or psychosis, people can absolutely have that happen to them. And the, and so people that carry, there's a couple of major diagnoses that, where this is involved, specifically schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. So, we now know an awful lot more about this whole thing than we've ever known, obviously. And so we know that these are effectively personality characteristics is the way we should be viewing all of these things. So whether you're OCD or a major depressive disorder or a, you know, ADHD disorder, you know, i.e., or whether you're a borderline personality disorder or you're a schizophrenia, we should just view all of this as personality. So, and it's all going to be ultimately percolated down to gene variation. So there are people that have the propensity for some very strange thinking. And what exactly causes them to slip from more functional on Thursday to next Thursday, quite a bit less functional, and maybe even floridly psychotic, where they're babbling nonsense and you can't understand what they're saying, or they're incredibly anxious and paranoid, etc. What exactly causes that is not known, but it's an inherent instability of that individual's brains. And they're put together in a particular way by, you know, thousands of genes that give rise to those characteristics. Now, in many cases, people that carry a bunch of these genes may be kind of odd their whole life, and they may have some odd thinking. They may be more paranoid than normal. It's very likely that they would be. They may hear things that other people don't hear. In other words, they have auditory hallucinations. They may occasionally, though more rarely, they may have visual hallucinations. This is true of both the schizophrenia group of people as well as the bipolar. Now, it turns out that the bipolar and schizophrenia were seen as very distinct in the history of psychology because they seem to look very different in certain presentations. However, now we know that it's the overlap of the genes responsible for both these things is very, very high. So, in other words, what we're looking at is thousands of little problems in the genetic code that give rise to some dysfunctional mental processes. Now, so the question is, can you go mad? In other words, can you be fine one day and absolutely crazy the next? Not very likely. More likely that, but what we do see is we see people that they might be functioning quite well, for example, in high school. And then around 19 or 20 or 21, sometime in there, they may have what we call a psychotic break, where they go through a period where they start to decline in terms of their clarity of their thinking. They may start to get more paranoid. They may have huge sleep disruption. And then what happens is that they may turn floridly psychotic and they may stay there for a while. Now, it's going to turn out that it's kind of like a wave. It's kind of like if you're going to vomit, you know what I mean? You know what that feels like to have a big wave where something is really feels out of control and terrible. Generally speaking, if nothing is done, then things will calm down. Okay. And they, and their psychotic quote break functioning, well, things will settle back in. And they may look worse than they did 2 years earlier, but they won't be as bad as they were 3 weeks ago when they were in the middle of a quote psychotic break. So that's kind of, in other words, what you're looking at, folks, is you're looking at some inherent instability in the system, and people have looked very hard at trying to figure out what caused this. So they'll say things like that, well, they were really stressed or their parents broke up or they lost their job or it's none of that's true. In other words, people have tried to figure out, are there environmental variables that come into the equation, psychological inputs that give rise to this? And the answer is no. And it's no surprise that that would be true. For the reasons that what you're seeing is sort of structural limitations in the brain. It would be like saying, a little old lady fell and broke her hip because she had osteoporosis. And what was the reason? Oh, it's because she was thinking that she was, you know, weak or whatever. It's like, no, her thought processes had nothing to do with it. Well, your thought processes have nothing to do with the fact that your brain may have built in structural weaknesses according as a result of a lot of mediocre genes that give rise to mediocre structures that cannot, you know, that can't maintain something unbelievably difficult, which is thought, feeling, and behavioral integrity that is optimal relative to your environment. So it's very tricky to do that. And so it's no surprise at all that we have people that have some parts that don't work too well, and that they give rise to what we're going to call madness. Now, notice that in principle, when you start saying, "Well, okay, what does it look like?" Well, a lot of anxiety, a lot of paranoia, loss of sleep, possibly, etc. So it's like, okay, well, exactly how is this that different than, for example, OCD? So let's take a look at, you know, some of my favorite OCD friends. Are they paranoid? You bet they're paranoid, okay? They're paranoid of everybody that wants to stick out their hand and shake their hand, okay? They're paranoid that if they send food back to the kitchen that somebody's going to poison the food. And you say, well, that's not crazy. That's just Larry. Okay. All right. So are they really anxious?
There are two options. Take it or leave it. That's what the restaurant, you know, in my head says.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. I mean, in other words, I don't think I've ever sent anything back because I got just enough paranoid in there. But my friend Larry certainly wouldn't. And so now what are we looking at? Well, We're looking at essentially the assessment of risk, threat, et cetera. What's the difference between Larry and a schizophrenic? Well, a schizophrenic very well maybe at some times be hearing voices that Larry doesn't hear. That's because Larry's brain is got better integrity of function because he doesn't have all those schizophrenia genes that give rise to that process. You can imagine if you did hear things that other people weren't hearing, you had auditory imagery in there, that you would suddenly be thinking, well, of course there's somebody talking to me through this wall. And they're whispering. I can hear people whispering. And why would they be whispering? They must be out to get me. In other words, these would be actually fairly reasonable inferences for the human mind to be making, given that it evolved in a Stone Age situation where it had a lot of conflicts with local people, i.e. in its own tribe and outside of its own tribe. And so there was always political problems and strife and et cetera, et cetera. So people were talking about you behind your back. Sometimes they were plotting about against you behind your back. So you can imagine that those being fairly normal circuits inside of humans, that if you put some of those bricks together with some faulty bricks, we're going to get a whole lot more of that. And if we add some disturbance in the imagery systems of the brain, then we get, you know, what we would call full-blown psychosis. So that's what going mad is. It is the periods of time in people that are genetically susceptible where they, where their brains lose the enough functional integrity to the point where they've substantially lost contact with the truth. So, you know, everybody operates under certain delusions. In other words, you don't know exactly what's true and you believe that this is true, but it turns out that that's not true. That's not that. That's just a limitation of your ability to understand reality. But these folks have their, you know, sensory apparatus effectively is not operating properly. And as a result, you can imagine if you had your sensory apparatus not operating properly, if you saw things and heard things and other people weren't acknowledging it, you would believe that there was possibly, you know, essentially a conspiracy against you. And so at any rate, that's what, quote, going mad is. And you know, such is life. You know, it turns out psychiatric medications can calm that stuff down pretty quickly, but at apparently great cost. In other words, so the tools that we have now to combat those processes, I believe, are worse than the disease. Is my reading of the evidence when I read Robert Whitaker, his book Anatomy of an Epidemic. So. Yeah, that's what going mad is. And fortunately, an awful lot of people that that go mad, for example, particularly the bipolar variety, which looks to be a less severe in terms of its general total disturbance than schizophrenia, then a lot of those people will be fine. They may have one or two or a handful of periods of a couple of weeks or so where they are not doing well, where a tremendous amount of their thinking and their actions and their feelings are not falling into consistent pattern with reality. And so I can remember a case of a doctor that I worked with that had a client that in a manic phase, which a lot of times lasts for a couple 3 weeks, took the entire family fortune and went to Las Vegas and gambled it all away. At the time, it was about $500,000.
Oh my God.
And so the obviously, so that's the kind of thing that can happen when people, quote, go mad. That's what we're talking about almost always when we say, did someone go mad? We're saying they're probably have a diagnosis of some schizophrenia type thing or bipolar, and they go through a particularly rough period in terms of their brain's, you know, integrity. Mm-hmm. All right, so that's that.
Thank you, Dr. Lyle. Our next question kind of falls in the same topic, which is, mm-hmm. what could cause a fully functional, productive member of society to have a nervous breakdown and become a total basket case? This listener further writes, conventional diagnoses include PTSD, anxiety, major depressive disorder, and the treatment has so far been treatment with more and more medications, whether in or outpatient. Is this just a function of personality? Is this person running a cost-benefit or a CB analysis that says it's better to be this way, even though they're miserable and claims that she wants to get back to work and life? And also, what is the best way to support her, or support a person like that in this state?
Yeah. Nervous breakdown, that's going to be different than, quote, going mad. Okay. So a person in a nervous breakdown is crying and tearful and exhausted and miserable and anxious, but they are not believing that, that the Martians are speaking to them through the television set, and they want that person to go and track down Sissy Spacek, and that Sissy Spacek wants to have their baby. So I met such an individual. Okay. So there's a big difference between, quote, a nervous breakdown, which is run-of-the-mill anxiety, overwhelm, depression. Big difference between that and as we get into a more severe psychotic process. All right. So nervous breakdowns. Well, the what this is a person who is, breakdown sounds so dramatic. It's basically a person is can be frozen in their motivation because they don't know kind of what to do. They are depressed because they may have faced a great deal of failure feedback, and so they don't know what to do to keep trying in whatever domain it is that they're experiencing this rather acute feedback. They are also, they could be very anxious because there might be significant payoffs for performance one way or the other. In other words, if they don't get something done, then they're going to lose this, that, or the other status or resources, etc. And they can also, they're often very tired. And so an awful lot of, to try to give you this to you straight from a clinician with, 35 years of clinical experience. The nervous breakdowns that I've seen are very often drug related. So the people have been using coffee, cigarettes, alcohol, stimulants, and they're really tired. And they can become exhausted, defeated. Essentially, their lives have been significantly out of balance behind whatever the challenges are. And they have exhausted their themselves, and their minds are biochemically out of balance. And so, of course, the last thing when they're biochemically out of balance that we would ever do is we would not want to introduce yet another drug which causes them to be even more imbalanced. So the psychiatric approach to this is, of course, ass backwards, which is exactly what we would expect. That instead, what we generally want to do is to essentially back the person out of the overwhelming challenges and get them to sleep. So that's where we would take people to a place like True North or Nathan's place at Fasting Escape or grandma's, granny unit, and just chill out. Okay. Sleep. And sometimes what the person needs is they need to sleep for 20 hours for, 3 days in a row like that. They need to withdraw off their coffee. They need to be told, no, you don't have to do this and you don't have to do that. And you don't have to worry about it because we've got plenty of time to manage these problems or whatever the challenges are. Well, what if my house is in the middle of foreclosure? Oh, well, there's really, if there's nothing for us to be done about it, then there's nothing to be done about it. Okay. How much equity is in there? Oh, well, $300,000. Well, after they sell that thing at auction, there's a good chance you're going to get some money back and then on to the next problem of life. In other words, whatever the problem is, unless we have your life literally at stake, we don't really have any reason to be so completely defeated, devastated, etc. So, and the mind is capable of managing whatever it is that these challenges are. However, it may not be very capable of managing it if it's been managing on 7 cups of coffee a day to be able to push its way through this big deadline, and therefore it's been adrenalized and exhausted etc. So pretty much the nervous breakdowns that I've seen in my career have been as a result of they've usually had recreational, in other words, crutch drugs been associated with it. And what we have is a person's mind is just wiped out. They're super tired and things are wiped out. So the biggest thing that we can do with someone that we know that's, quote, having a nervous breakdown is back up the question of what it is that we need to accomplish. And usually that is very little. Pretty much all you need to do is sleep, okay? Oh, well, I'm going to lose my apartment in 3 weeks. Okay, well, where are you going to go then? Okay, so let's make sure we have that problem solved so that your mind can relax. Does your grandmother have a hen house that you can stay in? You know, where would your next move be? And so this is where, as a psychologist, pretty much you quit being some fancy person trying to think things through of any complexity. And all we are is a social worker. Okay, we're basically saying, let's make sure that we understand how you are going to, you know, get enough food, get enough water, not freeze or burn to death, and have a place to poop. That's it. Okay. After that, so the big project goes in the tank and your company's all pissed at you and you get fired. Oh, well. Okay. That's all right. Worse things have happened to people. So I can remember I had a case like this, and it was a law enforcement officer had tremendous pressure on him as an expert witness at a huge trial. And this was not good. This was not good for him. It wasn't good for his family. It wasn't good for anything. It was the only thing that it was good for was the district attorney. And the district attorney was a very decent gal. And this guy, you know, felt an enormous sense of responsibility. But the expert witness problem was tricky. It was a super tricky case. And the DA was believing they had a case and that they needed to thread a very complex needle to make the case stick. And it involved putting this guy in some pretty tricky crosshairs about how he was going to answer for how it is that he had, you know, dealt with this investigation. And it was tricky, and he was overwhelmed. It was like a 3-year process, and he was definitely in recurrent, quote, nervous breakdowns. And finally, one day it dawned on the three of us, meaning his wife and I and himself, like, what the hell? Like, I didn't really understand. It had not been even discussed really as an option of him backing out. But once we started to confront that and realize, no, wait a minute. Why wouldn't we? Okay, and we had to run down through that whole thing. And in the next week or so, he went and approached the DA, and the DA was an absolute princess about it. She said, "Don't even worry about it. No problem. You got to take care of you, man." That was a beautiful thing to hear. And that individual did way better. There was a huge alteration in that individual's functioning over the next few months and then into the future. So again, nervous breakdown, overwhelmed people, too much pressure, you know, time pressure, money pressure, performance pressure, status loss issues, drugs toxifying the system, short of sleep. That is the recipe for a nervous breakdown. The solution is, how do we peel back all the pressure? How do we get this person out of all of the things that are interfering with that brain getting to an equilibrium, of which sleep, exercise, diet, and drugs are all of the variables to be paying very close attention to. I have a great deal of confidence in the mind's ability to essentially worry the amount that it should be worrying and take actions that it should be taking, provided that it isn't under bizarre non-Stone Age inputs. And non-Stone Age inputs are all the what we call the dietary drugs that can interfere with that, as well as the electric light bulb keeping people up, etc., as well as too much status and too much pressure on something and sort of not having thought through literally opting out of it all and actually thinking through the consequences of opting out of it all and realizing you don't need anything in this life. You need air, water, food, and temperature regulation. Everything else is, you know, is not essential. So let's just realize we don't have to dance to anybody's tune. Okay, and so once we sort of reestablish and dial back what the person needs to deal with, then we can slowly work our way through the options and how we're going to manage the different choices that we have with respect to the challenges that the person has.
Dr. Lyle, thank you so much. That made so much sense. I hope this listener gets some comfort from your answer.
All good. All right. Well, what else do we have, Nathan?
All right. Well, speaking to dancing to somebody else's tune, our next question is the following. Dear doctors, how do I get over small slights in an otherwise happy and healthy relationship? I'm probably more sensitive than the average bear. My partner of 5 years is great. We're mutually over-rewarded, magic 10%, the whole deal. But he has a habit of correcting me on the proper pronunciation of words whenever they come up, usually 1 to 3 times per year. The first few times I took it on the chin, but eventually I told him it really bothered me and made me feel stupid. For context, he is older and more educated, and I've always been insecure about this. Many of the words are either place names, for example, Mauritius, I don't even know how to pronounce that one, or sometimes it's just a slip of the tongue where I did not know, where I did know the correct pronunciation. I told him if he knew how much it hurt my feelings, he would not do it, and he understood that, but I guess he can't help himself because he still does it. Other small slights could be if he didn't show appreciation for a great meal that I make when I do all of the cooking. These incidents can set me off on a 3-day freeze out. I don't think he deserves me being angry with him for that long, and always wish I could just stop feeling angry. It took me a long time to even start bringing up hurt feelings because I've always felt so over-rewarded, but now I try to do things so I try so that things don't fester. I try to think of all his good qualities, but that doesn't work. Is it just a neuroticism-tinged disagreeability streak in me that I can't change? I tend not to think of myself as a disagreeable, but I always go out of my way to not hurt others' feelings. I'm an otherwise happy, cheerful person. So do you have any ideas on how to get over these slights? Me, 36, him, 43, 5 years relationship, blended family, not married.
Yeah, I don't want to appear to be some genius that knows the answer to everything. So this is what we have is, and I can't necessarily see through this, so I'm taking some things at face value here. So the slights, I mean, it seems pretty rare, and I can see there are a lot of people that are, remember, for example, him correcting your pronunciation is a way to display his intelligence. So it's we can see that that's a fitness indicator he's displaying, and he probably does that with other people under appropriate circumstances. You know, in other words, it's a little chip that's in there. I mean, I have that chip. God, I did that to my advisor once. God, I can't believe it. We just went back 4 decades into my memory. I still remember it like it was yesterday, and I can remember he was a nice enough guy. He like paused. I did it in a group.
Do you mind sharing the details?
Okay. No, I'm not going to share the details. So the point is that I could see how this could be perfectly and utterly reasonable, except that now we see that some of her frustration is leaking into other areas. So the question is whether or not he's doing some signaling with her about the fact that he's not that happy with certain things, or that he's essentially one of the ways that we go about in a non-optimal fashion to get more. Let's back up for a second. Relationships are fundamentally trades. So there isn't anything, quote, called a relationship that is not a trading process. That's what it is. So you are expending time and energy with that other individual at the expense of other things you could be doing with your time. The reason you do that is that, quote, relationship, which means a process of recurrent trading processes, seems like a very good value relative to what your options are. So that's what's happening. However, because these are trades, remember, there is some incentive, obviously, to try to get a better deal in the trade than the one that we have. And so if you're going to buy a used car, you know, you look that thing over and you say, well, you know, I would give you $6,000 for it, but there is that the three dings in the bumper. And they're saying, yeah, well, we know, I already figured that into the price. Okay, so the criticisms of the other person's value, their limitations, is one of the ways that we can get what we want but chisel the price down. So one of the motivations of criticizing somebody's pointing out their limitations with their vocabulary or not signaling our value of their meal is that we are essentially signaling to them that we're going to now do 5% less, but we expect everything that we are already getting. Okay, this is part of what I call the chiseling chip. So the that, you know, comes from my concept of, you know, in the old coins, it was a $20 doubloon, but you knocked a little corner off the gold, it was still worth $20, but you got a little chunk of gold in your pocket. Okay, so a lot of relationships wind up looking like this. So they begin with everybody hiding their liabilities and essentially trying to entice the other into the relationship by signaling very high value with, you know, very high benefit, very low cost. And very often those are loss leader advertisements, and they aren't true. And so pretty soon we find out what I call their dirty laundry. Okay. So now we find out what the real trade is, which is why a great many fledgling romances don't last for more than 90 days. Because 90 days, we finally vet what the real trade is, and then the trade's gone because it's not worth it after all. However, in a trade that is worth it and continues on, that doesn't make it immune from the chiseling chip. So I'm going to try to keep getting what I want out of this relationship, but I'm going to try to give you 1% less. And it's so part of little criticisms that people will level at their partners is going to be behind that issue, that there's a possible motivation to do a little bit of chiseling. So keep that in mind. So I'm not like the person's talking about how happy they are in the relationship and how it's fundamentally very solid. So I'm not critiquing that or suspecting that that's not true. I am, however, suspecting that that doesn't mean that you may not have a chiseling chip process there that could be giving rise to some of this. However, let's suppose in principle that even if you did, it's mild, but it's pretty irritating because we're hearing that she can freeze up for 3 days and really feel, you know, pretty upset, pretty angry, i.e. you're treating me unfairly and I'm considering threatening you to actually get you to treat me fairly. Because remember, that's what anger is. Anger is a signal. It's a communication that tells the person on the other side of it that you are treating me unfairly. And now I'm going to level a threat at you so that I will impose costs on you unless you stop. And so a person that is in a position of significant weakness in an exchange very often does this very quietly, i.e. passive aggressive. So they want the other person to get the signal, but they don't feel powerful enough. They kind of want the person to infer it and then figure it out, and then they want to see that the person feels guilty. Okay, the purpose of anger is to get resources, and the fundamental emotional response on the other side of anger that is planned. In other words, the person who is expressing the anger is expressing their outrage that you've treated me unfairly. The purpose of that is to, the proximal purpose is to cause guilt. And when the other person experiences guilt, they basically have the inference, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry, I treated you unfairly. And then the next sentence is as I'm reporting the informational content, the structural informational content of what's inside the person's brain when they're feeling guilty. It's, oh, let me see what I can do to make up for this. Okay, so whether they say it or not or think it or not, that is the process that their mind is going through. And so when we're angry, we are hoping and expecting to some degree that that's what the result will be on the other side. But you can imagine that when a person is angry, they have a range of alternatives and options and outcomes that they're calculating. And if they're an individual that's in a position of weakness, then they may be thinking, you know what? I don't want to come out and say what I'm upset about, because what that may provoke is the other person may say, hey, you know what? If you're pissed at me for that, you can just take the whole relationship and shove it, because I don't need it. I'm out of here. Okay. And so our person who's in a relative position of weakness may not feel like they can afford to take that risk and come out with their anger and thereby get rebuked and rejected and abandoned. So instead, what they do is they, quote, go silent. They give them the silent treatment. Okay. And they have little cold signals. And what those signals are about is they're saying, I'm angry with you. And I'm leveling a threat at you, and I am considering costs that I can impose on you. And one of them I can impose on you is your feeling of peace of mind that everything's cool in our relationship, because it's not. Okay? And there, if I do this, then you may start thinking, what could she be pissed about? And then you may be thinking, oh, it could be that thing that I said. And then it's like, oh, I actually feel bad about that. It just sort of came out. I didn't mean anything by it, or et cetera. But boy, I sure wouldn't have wanted you to take that the wrong way. And so now here comes Prince Charming falling all over himself, apologizing, okay, and communicating that he feels guilty. So therefore, our passive-aggressive, quiet, not in a position of power individual was able to signal her anger at low risk, okay, to possibly accomplish her goals without taking the big risk of being openly angry. All right. Now, so that's the fact that we have some of that going on tells me that it is quite possible that she's facing some non-trivial chiseling chip behavior. And that chiseling chip behavior can include correcting a person's pronunciation with them. In other words, that could be a signal from the more powerful individual that I'm not that impressed with you, you know what I'm saying? And therefore, I'm not necessarily going to pay the full fare in this relationship the way I did a year ago. It's a warning. It's a renegotiation tactic. Now, I'm not saying that it is. I'm just saying that it might be, okay? And the same thing is true if we're not signaling any appreciation for the things that you bring to the relationship, which you feel like would be reasonable that they would signal their appreciation. So again, that would be like, I don't say thank you if I feel like you owed it to me. So the and particularly if I feel like if I lent you $5,000 and you're supposed to pay back $5,000 today and you pay me back $2,000, I don't say thank you. I'm like, okay, all right. It's like, I don't say, well, thank you. No, I don't. And the same way that when somebody doesn't signal their appreciation when we do something for them, they may be feeling like, hey, I feel like it's out of balance anyway. I'm not going to say thank you and act like everything's hunky-dory, because it's not hunky-dory. So that's so these are all kinds of considerations that I'm trying to read into an unbelievable small amount of information, but I'm trying to map this thing out as best I can. Now, let's suppose that that it is actually that we have naturally sort of a moderately emotionally unstable person. And so as a result, moderately unstable, and so as a result, she ends up taking things that are actually mild, normal, rough and tumble processes, and in fact is doubling their significance. In other words, they are very small little chisel maneuvers, or not even, but it looks like they are, and it looks like they're more significant, and therefore that's why she gets feeling like, hey, this is unfair, and yet I'm in a position of weakness, and now I'm all upset. Okay, and now I'm playing the only card I've got, which is passive aggressive. Now, what we want to move this towards is we want to move this towards what I would call crystal clear. So crystal clear, and if this happens, this is happening fairly often, you could sort of do a little kind of a thing where we could say, listen, that every once in a while, I want, you know, we either do this sort of formally, but usually that doesn't work, where we periodically, we make it kosher to, you know, call a little family meeting, a little relationship meeting. And so it's good to do this, you know, to have that as a thing that has happened. Some people that don't know what they're doing, or they want to hide, or there are big messes and it's all impossible, they weren't going to go to quote therapy. Well, good luck to y'all. Okay. Instead, probably the better move is going to be to just have this process take place between yourselves. So there's not some third party watching, and then everybody's grandstanding for the crowd and trying to play up to the therapist that I'm the reasonable one and she's the nut. Okay. Which is exactly what goes down. So instead, what we want to do is we want to say, listen, you know, things come up between us from time to time, and I get upset, and then I feel like, you know, I feel like I'm, you know, kind of in a weak position for one reason or another. I'm not sure I'm on the right side of it, but I'm still upset, and I go quiet, and then I don't think that's good for us. I think it's not a good pattern. So instead, if something comes up for me, I'd like to, you know, be able to have this family meeting where we sit down and we sort of clear a space, and we take half an hour, and we have something to eat, and we light a couple of candles, and we take out a pad of paper, and we kind of talk about things from time to time. Are you okay with that? Yeah, 'cause that's how I want to, you know, if we've got some conflicts that come up, I kind of want to talk them through because I don't like to sit on them. Now, that's reasonable. That's incredibly reasonable. I think the idea of saying, well, we're going to do this once a week, you're going to drop it because you're only going to want to do it when there's an issue. And so when you want to do it because there is an issue, or you feel like you want to get through a mess because there is an issue, then you want to have it in place that we have this process that we do. So we're going to have some food, and we're going to have some decent lighting and comfort, and where we're going to sit down with a pad of paper and a pen so we can take some notes on this, and we're going to talk. Okay, and try to talk it through. And so this is the beginning of what I call crystal clear. So crystal clear is that people take turns and somebody starts, and the idea is the other person, their job is to listen and ask clarification questions, but they are not allowed to argue, rebut, correct, or anything else. If you pick up the fact that the other person is making a mistaken inference or has a mistake of fact, you write it on the piece of paper. And you say, hold on a second, let me write that down. Okay, so if I was listening to her and she was all twisted up about something, and I said, okay, we're going to begin. I want you to tell me, like, what you're thinking, what's on your mind. Just give me the whole thing. Okay, well, there's this and that and this and that and this and that. Okay. And then you did this and then I see this and I'm like, okay, hold on a second. So I'm going to write it down. Anything where I feel like, and so you were thinking that I called so-and-so back, you know, did that? You thought that I did that? Okay. Let me write that down. So we make sure that we get a full accounting. We want to know what is inside. For example, if you're the guy on the other side of this, you want to know everything that's in that girl's head. Okay. And then you're going to feed it back. Okay. You're going to say, so let me get this straight. So you're feeling this and you're feeling that, and it's associated with this, that, and the other. And then when I did this, you felt that, and you wanted to say this, but you didn't say it. But what you did do is this, and that's what happened. And then you're feeling this, and then I did this, and et cetera, et cetera. And so this all comes down to these are the things that are swirling around. Do I have that right? Yes. There's something tremendously satisfying about having someone reiterate what your thinking and feeling is and the logic, why it is that you're angry and why you feel like it was unfair and da, da, da. To have the person that to get the entire thing out, if it takes 17 minutes, you sit there and you take those questions. If you try to short circuit it, which I'll explain in a minute why you will. Okay. If you try to short circuit it, it's just going to prolong the agony. So we want to shut up and listen. And when we feed it back, a lot of times they'll say, wait a second, not quite right. I'm also upset about this, that, and the other. Okay. So we have to include that this, that, and the other is also in this equation. Yes. We want to get to the point where the person who's upset can feel like they have been fully heard and understood down through every tributary of the reasoning and every you know action potential in that nervous system. That's what we want. When they get there, they can relax, and now we know a pretty well cinemascope view of what is their beef, where they think things have been unfair. And now we can say, okay, let's look at this because I've got some disagreements. I feel like you're making some inferences that aren't correct. So now let me go down through here and explain how it is that I see this on this or that dimension. Okay. So this is now crystal clear the other direction. Now the person number one has to shut up. Now this is the plan. And, you know, it doesn't have to take that long. Seems like it's agonizing, but it doesn't really have to take that long. And a significant, you know, for example, if there's some significant hurt about some little issue, it's like that woman, for example, may need to spin for 10 minutes about all this. Like, gosh, I'm just so frustrated. I don't understand, you know, what it is. Why it is that you're correcting me like that? And I feel like you mean to do this and you mean to do that, et cetera, et cetera. We want to get everything that's in her head. And if you're a partner in a very good romantic relationship, you ought to be highly motivated to know what's going on inside your partner's head. It should be super important information, particularly if they're unhappy. Okay. So that's how crystal clear is done. And very often in the doing of crystal clear, the problems can be significantly solved or they're uncovered. Okay, so somebody may get cagey and crystal clear and not get clear. And they may be resistant towards giving up a position or a part of the argument, etc. So we may uncover the fact that all is really not well in that relationship. At the fundamental level, let me tell you what's being attacked when there are conflicts of this type of nature in a relationship. What's being attacked is a person's confidence that they are in fact accepted. That is the fundamental issue in a relationship. It isn't whether or not, you know, he spent that extra beer money on himself and his buddies at the bar rather than bring home flowers for her, which you haven't brought me any flowers in 2 years, but you always used to. Okay? No, it's not about a dispute about that money. It's about what that means in terms of how valuable I am to you. So in the relationship process, in the trades that go on, there are also inferences about how valuable you find me. This is why the relationship, why my little company is called Esteem Dynamics. It is the dynamics of the esteem signaling in the relationship that is the enjoyment of the relationship or its suffering. So we want to know what the real esteem processes are that are in the relationship. And if the person really esteems you, then when you squawk and you say, listen, I feel like when you do this and that, you don't value me that much. You may must not find me that beautiful. I have a feeling that if you found me beautiful and sexy and were really interested and were really proud of me, then you wouldn't be doing things to chisel away, you know, my self-confidence or to criticize me. That, and the guy may say, you know what, the truth is I'm doing it because I feel like I'm over-rewarded and I feel like you might feel like you're too high and mighty and that you, you know, that I want to actually, I find myself trying to reduce your confidence because I feel like maybe I'm not enough. So we don't know what those signals mean, but if there's toxic signals, we want to smoke it out. Okay? And so if we're not sure, we float hypotheses. All this idea of, oh, well, don't say what's in their mind, just say what's in my mind. No, what's in your mind is your speculation about what's in their mind. And say it. Okay, I'm worried that makes me think that maybe you think this and maybe you feel that. Okay, so at the end of the day, folks, we either have a very good relationship or we have something in the middle or we have a lousy one. In other words, the relationship sort of is what it is. And what we don't want and all that we can do in any kind of therapeutic process is we can reduce the unnecessary suffering. The unnecessary suffering that takes place in relationships under conflict is when people are misreading the cues that they're observing and they are inferring worse than is true. Okay, that's a problem. And that's where the unnecessary suffering takes place. That may or may not be the case. Okay, so we have to if we want to feel better and get to the other side of something, we have to figure out what that negative feedback and conflictual process actually means. Okay, and we do that by a crystal clear process and by we're open and vulnerable about our fears, about what it all means. And then we find out where that other person is. We may find out that they're having cognitive dissonance about whether they want to be in the relationship. And they are, in fact, being a little bit shitty because they're not so sure. It's like, whoa, well, part of me was inferring that. And that's why I'm really anxious. And that's why I'm upset. Fair enough. Okay, but maybe it's now been articulated or signaled. Fair enough. We didn't make it any worse by having the meeting. Okay, our hope is that the relationship and its status is actually better than we are fearing, that we are actually making worst case scenario inferences in some of these conflictual communications. And it's going to turn out that if we crystal clear, that other person looks at us and says, no way, that isn't even remotely what I'm thinking or feeling. You're completely misreading that. Okay. As you know, a person that's been on the planet for a while in a few relationships, the truth is it's all over the map. So I've had people, you know, worry about things. And then finally I hear about what they're worried about. And I look at them and I'm like, God, trust me, that is the last of your worries. That's not even on my radar. Okay. Other times I had trepidation or I had concerns about a relationship and I was definitely, emotionally unavailable and throwing up smoke and didn't want them to know where I was really at. And so I was trying to work out where I was in the relationship and how I felt about it. Okay. So anybody trying to figure that out, good luck. Because the truth is that, you know, if a relationship's in trouble, people can be very difficult to figure out where they're at. When a relationship's good, it's not that hard. They embrace crystal clear. It's like, oh God, the last thing I want is there to be any unnecessary conflict here. Okay. So let's get clear. You're beautiful. You're brilliant. You're fabulous. You're a great cook. And this relationship is super important to me. It's highest priority. And if I do something like that, I feel sick about it, but I can't help it. I've got a disagreeable chip in my head and it goes off from time to time. Okay. But I'm sorry about it. I'll find a ways to make it up to you. If your relationship is good, that's the kind of reaction you'll get. Yeah, if there's deeper problems, things will look differently. So crystal clear. And your job is to have it sort of semi-formal, where we sit down and we're talking about the relationship, and we do it in this way. So the person that anybody can start, and you can take turns, or you can say, listen, I need to start. And the rules of crystal clear is I have to talk until I'm done talking, and you can ask me questions, and then I want you to tell me, you know, to summarize it for me at the end, because I want to make sure you understand where I'm at and what I'm going through. Or we can start the other way. I see that you're in some distress. I can tell we've got a lot of conflict. Tell me where you're at. I want to have a full understanding. So that's how we do crystal clear. Mm-hmm. All right, Nathan.
Thank you, Dr. Lyle. You mentioned that the people will desire sometimes to short circuit this process.
Yes.
So can you talk about that? Why would that be?
Yeah. One reason is that they're hiding. In other words, there's conflicts that they don't want to face. And so they're in the relationship, but they're in the relationship with, there's some motivation for being deceptive. And that doesn't make them bad people, and it doesn't make the relationship doomed. It just means that at that point, they can understand that there's conflicts between them and the other person. They're not sure where they're at, and they're not sure they want to get confronted. So that means your relationship isn't in the greatest space. It means it's under a lot of challenge. When a relationship is exceptionally good, then the people have a tendency to, they have the opportunity to do what Jen and I call golden play. Okay, and golden play is that it's like the gift of the Magi from O. Henry. It's that what's going to make me happy is making you happy. So therefore, because your emotional expressions of happiness with me and that I can observe in you are so important to me, and they so resonate, and it's such a critical feature of my own happiness, then I want to know what that is. Okay? So golden play is that if two people are feeling relationship is very valuable and they are invested enough and decent enough humans that they can play golden, then sometimes under conflict, all we have to do is start that golden maneuver in the right direction, and it sorts itself out. Okay. You are not in a golden play situation. Doesn't mean you can't have a decent relationship, but you're not in a golden play situation where one party is feeling, you know, naturally by virtue of their personality, that they are sufficiently disagreeable that they're attempting to chisel you. And so they may do that with periodic criticism or a lack of complimenting. They may be semi-consciously trying to cause you to feel insecure so that you'll hustle and give them 10% more for 10% less. If you're in that situation, doesn't mean that these people, that you can't have relationships with such individuals, but you will not have relationships at the level of which human beings can have relationships. Okay? Human beings, not all human beings, but many human beings are capable of being in a golden play situation. And when you find that, people that are there, they will know exactly what it is that I'm talking about. That what makes you happy is what makes me happy, and therefore that's the thing that I'm most focused on. And when that's coming back to you from the other direction, then you have the ultimate of a virtuous cycle. And that's what we hope to. We hope to rescue that from any misunderstandings. Okay.
Well, all right. Dr. Lyle, thank you so much. May we all have plentiful golden plays in our life.
All good. Yeah. All right, Nathan, I think that's plenty for one night.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Lyle. We really appreciate the level of detail that you went into in these explanations. It's exciting to learn more about these processes. I mean, every episode that I listen to when you explain these things, I learn something new. So really appreciate it.
Cool. All right. Well, everybody, we should have Dr. Jen should be back on our next time around. So we'll look forward to livening things up a little.
Perfect. All right. Have a good evening, Dr. Lyle.
All right. We'll see y'all soon. Thanks, Nathan.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.